You're listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 131. Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. Today on the show, we are joined by Caitlin Spradley and Kat Cannell, two women who recently undertook a fascinating journey, all in the name of protecting endangered salmon. I'm joined now by these two amazing women who are going to share their story. Introduce yourselves.
Okay, well, my name's Caitlin. I'm 27. I'm originally from Texas. Pretty much, I think the most correct summation of who I am is just extreme outdoor enthusiast, from a conservation, from a recreational, from all different aspects of what that means. I grew up around horses. They've kind of always been like this constant but shifting as far as what I do with horses growing up. But I'm also pretty active as a climber and a fisherwoman. And I race mountain bikes, et cetera, et cetera. I just really love being outside. And that pretty much dictates how I live my life.
Awesome.
She is awesome. She really is. I'm Kat Cannell, and I'm a horse girl, a horse lover, and also love being outdoors. And I grew up in Stanley, Idaho, and always had horses on our ranch, and just kind of took and morphed my love for horses trail riding and turned it into a long distance riding passion. And did I miss anything?
I mean, a lot. You're pretty cool. You do a lot of really cool things, but that works.
I'm a photographer. My husband and I are Middle Fork Outfitters. I don't know. We just like being outside. It's good stuff.
Awesome. Well, that's a good starting point. Let's talk about this recent voyage that the two of you undertook. I mean, maybe just give us an introduction to this. You know, what was this journey? What was the sort of purpose behind it? And what did it actually look like?
Ever-changing. it's morphing. It still is.
Or maybe you can start with like the inspiration. Like what, you know, where did the sort of seed of this idea come from?
Yeah, so Kat already has kind of this extensive experience as a long distance horseback rider. And so she'd spent last year, she did two really extensive trips, and I wasn't able to join her on either of those. But since she'd already like gathered this back knowledge and experience of these trips, and she was like, well, you should do a long distance ride together, was kind of something that we kind of plotted. We'd done some shorter stuff, but we were like trying to kind of come up with this longer ride that we could do together. And here in the Sun Valley area, we had an extreme winter.
There was
so much snow. So we're sitting in Kat's kitchen, ironically drinking wine, in like late October, early November.
Can't even remember.
And there's somewhere snow in there. Everywhere. Yeah. And we're trying to, okay, so well, how can we start a ride in the spring, because both of our jobs dictate that we go in during this like slack season, not summer, not winter. And so we were like, we need to follow the snow melt back home. Let's start at the ocean. Okay, so that transformed into, well, oh my goodness, let's follow the salmon run home. We'll do exactly what the salmon do, just a little off from what their timing is, which then transformed into, okay, well, let's make this like a message for salmon. Like, let's turn this into a way that we can advocate for salmon as a whole, especially our Idaho salmon that travel this incredible distance over all of these insane obstacles to come back to where we live. So that's kind of like how the ride morphed into two girls drinking wine, saying, let's go on this long horseback ride, into let's make this journey into something that's more meaningful for all of humanity and the like, more than just that.
Yeah. And then it kind of morphed a little farther, about a month before we left. A coworker of mine at the Sun Valley Stables, decided she wanted to join, and we took her on, and her name's MJ Wright. And unfortunately she can't be here right now because she's on her ranch in Nevada. But, so Caitlin and I started the trip in Astoria, Oregon, and MJ flew, she was in Iceland at the time and flew directly from Iceland to Portland and joined us. Her first day of the ride was through downtown Portland with us. And that was a pretty epic day.
So you had this crazy, awesome, amazing idea. You decided you were going to act on it. And there's this message behind it. Did you have like a plan for how you were going to get this message out or how you're going to sort of tell this story?
Like 2 weeks before we left, we had a friend. Well, she wasn't a friend at the time, but like she's become one of our best friends. I just kind of like knew of her, called up this woman who does women's films, and she's like focusing on women in the outdoors. Her name is Meredith Richardson. And she immediately, when I told her about what we were doing, like dropped everything and totally passion project jumped on board. And she got together a crew, and pretty much the whole entire ride was documented. But as you know, as a fellow filmmaker, half the battle, or like documenting it and actually filming it, is like minuscule compared to post-production. And so now we have like this daunting post-production game that we're playing, and pretty much we're still trying to get our message out there. We have made stickers that we're kind of trying to make go viral. Make redfish red is what they say. And we kind of mocked them off of the Keep Tahoe Blue stickers. And we wanted to give Idaho its own kind of like Keep Tahoe Blue. Everybody in Idaho knows what Redfish Lake is. But not many people understand like how devastated it is. Like, it's still beautiful and people are going there and enjoying their summers there, but like the lake is pretty much barren compared to what it used to be. And so we're trying to teach people that. And so yeah, our message, like the way that we're getting this message out there, first those stickers, second this film. And when we were actually on the trail, the way we spread the message was horses are like a huge attraction. Like, you see a horse walking through downtown Portland and it's going to stop you in your tracks. And just anywhere, really, like we were, you couldn't miss us. I mean, there were 7 horses and 3 women, and we were riding down the side of roads. We were riding on dirt roads. We got to ride up the Selway in the backcountry, coming over into Idaho and, or into Montana, but down into the Maine is what I meant. And, pretty much like everywhere we went, people, you know, we were a magnet to be able to spread this message. Like, if we had done the same thing on bikes or on foot, like nobody would have given us 2 glances. I mean, they've just been like, oh, people walking or people riding their bike, but 7 horses and 3 women, that's a really good way to get some attention. So yeah, that was, but that we only reached the people who saw us on the trip. And so now with this film, we're going to try to make a bigger splash.
You chose the route based upon the actual route that salmon take to get from the ocean to Redfish Lake. But there must have been like quite a bit of planning that went into sort of deciding like how you were going to follow that route. I mean, was it difficult to figure out, you know, how you were going to follow this, the journey of the salmon?
Yes, it was really difficult. again, I'm deferring to Kat's experience from her previous rides. She had really mastered how to utilize Google Maps of all things. On how to use the satellite images to try to find kind of like how we, because, you know, on horseback, we only travel 3 miles per hour, which means a really good day is anywhere between, I mean, an average day for us is between 20 and 25 miles a day. So we're not going very far every day. But the logistics of finding a home for the night for 7 horses and then, and 3 girls who are like, hi, can we camp? Is challenging. And I will, you know, before I continue with that, I will say that of all the places where we were traveling through a lot of private property, tons of it, and there wasn't a lot of public land where we were, which required us to knock on a lot of doors to kind of facilitate us being able to rest in the evenings and give our horses like the food and rest that they needed in order to continue. And we were only turned away twice. And we knocked on tons of doors. So the generosity of people was astounding. and the hospitality that people extended to complete strangers and seven grass-destroying beasts was incredible. But back to the route, we did have kind of like a general plan starting out. We actually had four or five, most of that deviation happening in Idaho, just because of the snowpack. And we also encountered some difficulties with snowpack that we weren't anticipating, just because of the differences in the snow line between our home and in Idaho and in Washington and Oregon. So pretty much what it came down to is we had two to three different downloaded GPSs, Google Maps being one of them, and we would try to isolate where we thought horse-friendly property would be within our mileage range, and we would just blindly hope for the best that those people would let us camp there for the most part. And that came down, Kat's got this brilliant eye for spotting round pins, which is usually a good indication that there are horses around. And or at least had been in the past. And
every time we saw a round pen, they said yes. Like, you zoom in on Google Earth, and it felt like such a creeper. Like, this round pen. And then we, like, show up, and these people are like, oh, yeah, we've got a round pen. We've got places in the back. And I want to be like, I know.
So, yeah, we were scoping you out, Pacific Northwest. We were looking at you at Google Earth in great detail.
So yeah, Google Maps is like an incredible tool.
Yeah, that's generally what we did for 1,000 miles.
Yeah, that's super interesting, right? I mean, like, kind of for two reasons. I mean, one being your use of technology in order to sort of route find, I think is very interesting, right? But also, I mean, as you said, just the generosity of just random people who you guys. I mean, obviously they're not random. I mean, you're looking for evidence that. That they had horses or had in the past, right? Because they'd be more likely to say yes to you. But still, I mean, you know, every single day, every single night to have to like knock on someone's door who you don't know in order to like get permission to spend the night. I mean, that in and of itself is a super fascinating experience, you know, and I think specifically because your crew is undertaking this mission, this conservation mission, right? Which I think a lot of people would associate with maybe more liberal beliefs, right? And you're, you know, walking through these very conservative areas. Like, I guess I just wonder, like, what kind of conversations you had about, like, the mission behind this journey did you have with these folks who you met along the way? And, like, how did they respond to that?
That was a really cool part of our journey that we did document. We got to get some interviews with some of these people. We got to film some of these conversations we had with these people. And it was like all over the charts from the first place we stayed. We stayed with this vet and outside of Astoria. And he like was so passionate about saving these salmon that like he cried when he was talking to us about it. And we asked him what it would take to save the salmon. And he just like point blank, he's like, a revolution. That's what it'd take. And that kind of set like the tone for our trip. And then all the way to camping with ranchers and farmers next to the Columbia and the Snake Rivers, especially on the Snake where the four dams are being targeted. We definitely had some people make it very clear that like what their opinions were about the dams, but at the same time, they were so welcoming still. And like, they were so kind and they put us up and brought us beers and like, were just really amazing people. And they knew that we were riding to save the salmon, and really everybody had one thing in common, no matter what their stance was on the dams or on the, how to save the fish, the one common theme is that people want to save them. People want to see them coming back. We didn't meet one person that was like, fuck them. You know, we like every single person we met was on the same page of like, yeah, we need to figure something out to save them. And so that was kind of like our intention from the get go was we knew that we were going to be going through these different zones of like extreme liberal near Portland and then extreme conservative near the dams. And we weren't really affiliating with either side. We weren't affiliating with like our own opinions. Really, what we were just trying to do was bring people together and show them the common ground of, like, we've all got the same thing at heart. So let's come together instead of, like, fight about it.
That's super awesome, you know, and I think that's something that is important for more people to recognize, right, is that, like, despite these sort of categories, you know, that folks get put in sort of politically, I was going to say when you talk to people face to face, but even better when you, like, approach them, you know, with a crew of horses and knock on their door.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they treat you with kindness and respect, you know, 9 times out of 10. Even if, you know, 90% of your beliefs are disparate, you know. I think that in and of itself, even separate of, you know, the sort of central message you were trying to convey about the salmon, is a very important message for people all across the U.S. to know, right?
Yeah, totally.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about what it was like to ride through Portland, right? I mean, to ride through, like, a big city.
I want to let Caitlin answer this, but I have to say I haven't even told you this yet, but there was an article done on us on Outside Online, and this photographer, John Webster, took a picture, and it's, like, hands down my favorite picture of the entire trip. And it's Caitlin in downtown Portland. And there's, like, five or eight people next to a bus stop just staring at her. And, like, you see their backs and you see her, she's on her horse and she's, like, staring back at them with, like, this what the fuck face at them. And, like, she's staring back at them with, like, why are you staring at me? Like, kind of look. And I just thought it was so funny because it wasn't like a big smile or like, hey, or like spreading the word. It was like, what are you looking at? You know what I'm talking about?
I was giving them a sticker.
Do you know what I'm talking about though? That picture's so funny.
Yes, I was trying to spread the message. but anyway, yes, it was Portland. quite the experience. We chose Portland on purpose. We had options of riding around Portland, but we felt like it would be really meaningful to reach a larger audience to ride right through that area because it is such a shock factor. I mean, we aren't just like, I mean, it's not like people in Portland are completely like they've not seen a horse before. I mean, there's mounted policemen. I mean, it's not that insane, I feel like. But the fact that we have laden pack horses at the time, we also had additional riders with us for that day. So, I mean, we were a full string of animals riding through downtown Portland. I remember riding past like glass cubicles. Granted, it's like pouring rain. We have all this really nice rain gear, but we've been soaked in rain for so long that we've defaulted to just anything. So we have ponchos on as well. And we rode past these glass cubicles and I remember these people just like, they stopped. One of them dropped their pen and they all like just slack jawed, just like, what? And we like rode by and,
cause we were like on a bridge and it was like a skyscraper. So they were like third floor. It was like something weird. And so like, we were like riding by like this third floor, like office meeting.
And I mean, we rode our horses across like 8 lanes of traffic. We crossed huge bridges.
The Hawthorne Bridge.
We rode across the Hawthorne Bridge. And I mean, our horses killed it. I mean, for those that are listening that may not be familiar with horses, like this is a huge undertaking for a horse. Just the stimulus involved with the lights and the noise and the people and the movement and weird sounds. It's big and they did so well.
The only thing Pungo, my horse, wasn't crazy about was the trolley cars or like the electric bus, what is that called?
Yeah, trolleys, right? Yeah, Portlandiers call them trolleys.
Okay, yeah. These trolley cars, like I think he could hear like this high pitch whirring or something, and every time we came to the tracks he was like, I don't know.
I'm not sure. But luckily we must have just hit the lights right because we got green lights most of the way.
We hit every green light on Salmon Street.
So
I
think it was kind of cool how we were able to, we went to the red on Salmon Street. So red obviously being a huge part of our ride, R-E-D-D. And there's a place called The Red on Salmon Street. So we were able to, like, ride our horses there. There's a parking lot that they could be safe away from traffic. And we were able to answer questions and kind of hang out there before, like, making our exit out of Portland. And a memorable experience, yeah. One would say.
One of the coolest horseback riding days of my life. Yeah. It's so cool.
So, yeah, that was Portland.
Yeah.
Neat. Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, riding through the big city was sounds like it was definitely a highlight. I mean, tell me about another, like, important moment along the trip, right? Whether it was sort of like a high point or a low point, like, you know, what else, like, really stands out, either because it was super challenging or, like, really amazing?
There's so many things.
Oh, man. Two come to mind.
Okay, you say your two and then I'll say one.
Well, dollar and then the other part, the losing.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I'll just do a quick rendition of what I feel like are two, like, big parts.
Yeah, those were big parts.
And then, so coming into Hood River was a particularly challenging part of the ride because because the snow was more than we expected. So we were actually forced, this is kind of surrounding Hood River area, but we were on Highway 84 for a long time. And, not an easy road to travel along. And we encountered some obstacles in that area, but ultimately where we ended up was in Hood River. And we, stayed with this super, super nice woman, Margo, in Hood River. And we were, Kat and MJ and I at the time had been bouncing around the idea of potentially, adding another horse to our team, for various reasons, having a rotating horse, we had other horses that probably could use a break. And we had, at the time, the option of bringing in a mule from home that we could use for the rest of the journey. So we'd already been having this conversation. And, you know, we were talking with Margo, and she owns an operation there. And she said that she'd recently sold a horse for $1. And Kat and I, we were standing next to each other. And I distinctly remember, like, turning, and we both, like, looked at each other. And we were like, Kat's like, do you have another horse for $1? and therefore we purchased a horse for $1. He's now mine.
Caitlin's horse, his name is Dollar.
And he was named Dollar just for this act. But, man, it was something. Just, he needed to be vet checked. He needed to get shoes on. He needed all of this stuff needed to happen for us to travel across state borders. So it was our one rest day, and we're, like, rushing this horse to the vet and, like, getting all of this stuff done. We know nothing about him. This is crazy. No one buys a horse for $1 in the middle of nowhere when they have no access to a truck and trailer. This is stupid. But we did it.
Yeah.
And it was awesome.
And he's, like, the coolest horse ever.
He turned in to be, like, a super cool horse, but we added a horse en route in Hood River. And that was I still have him. He's a really cool, cool horse. And another big thing that happened, and I'll probably have Kat help me with this one, but we had just come back over Lost Trail Pass, and so we're close to home at this point. For those of you that aren't familiar with the geographical location, we are about a week or so away, and so we're feeling it good. Like, we feel the draw of home. We're in familiar territory. We recognize this place, and we wasn't a super great camping spot. And there wasn't a lot of feed available for the horses as far as, like, natural grasses. It was a pretty cramped, small area. We use a electric fence to house the horses overnight. And there was a lot of elk moving around, et cetera, et cetera. But long story short, the horses got out that night because they spooked through the fence. So we lost 7 horses in literally thousands and thousands of acres of wilderness. And that was, you know, people lose horses like that, packers at least, and they lose them for months, and they lose them into the winter and then never see them again. Like, so this is a really scary thing for us. And it happened at 8:30 at night, and we were all, like, kind of in our sleeping bags, like, watching the horses, like, we should do something about this. And when they pushed through the fence, we all ran out in our underwear and chased them through the woods in our flip-flops. And it was just quite something. We ended up finding them.
24 hours
within later. 24 hours. And so we had all 7 horses recovered, no serious injuries. Everyone was fine, albeit a little dehydrated, but that was a good adrenaline rush, especially because we were smelling the barn. I would say within a week of being home, as a good reminder, like, you got to be on your toes all the time with horses. You can't, you know, even on any adventure, you can't let your guard slide it.
Yeah.
So, it was a good learning experience for all of us. And at least I count that as, like, I can say that I'm at least a halfway decent real packer now, because I've lost horses and recovered them. I never want to do it again. It's checked off.
Type 3 fun.
But, I consider that like a, I don't know, what do you call
it? An accomplishment.
A mental point in your packing career.
Yeah. Yeah. It's official. We're packers. So for me, something that like that should be talked about is that like was a very big like punctuation point for the trip was coming home. And people ask me like for months or like, I mean, people still ask me, like, we walk around town and I mean, we can't go anywhere really without somebody being like, how was your ride? Did you camp every night? Does your butt hurt?
How many showers did you take?
What'd you eat? Can't go anywhere without people stopping us, which is fun. But at the same time, I think that the hardest part about the trip was coming home. Like the hardest part was actually like coming back and like decompressing. And it ended so abruptly. And that's something that I think gets kind of lost in expedition worlds when people are talking about their expeditions, is like, they'll tell the story of like what they did and then that's it. And it's like, really, like this has had a lasting wave in our lives. And, the last 24 hours of our trip, we had a horse get injured. I got bucked off and I got injured. In the last 3 freaking miles, I got bucked off. And then while we were at our final destination, the horses, 3 or 4 of the horses spooked and like teared apart a fence. And it was like all this like bad stuff happened like within the last 24 hours. And then we just like left and like went home. And MJ went back to Nevada and Caitlin and I both went back to like busy work lives. And it was like done. And that was hands down the hardest part for me anyway. And so, yeah, I don't know. I guess like for me, like when I look back on the trip, like I think of it in so many amazing ways. But at the same time, it's like when people ask me what the hardest part was, that was definitely it.
I've done some long distance backpacking. And I feel like it's the same type of thing in the sense that over the course of months and months of time, you get used to this routine, which is very different than the normal routine that you have for like your normal life in society, right? And there's a lot of like positive things about that new routine, right? And then, like you said, all of a sudden the trip's over and it's like, oh, I have to go back to my real life now. I can't just keep like walking, you know, like
this. Yeah, it's weird. It's like, wait, I'm supposed to be doing 25 miles today. You have like panic about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so but like a highlight, I don't know. I guess it was just all a highlight.
Yeah, there were lots of, I mean, we could talk for hours. About how all of the like really amazing just experiences we had on this ride. So we won't bore you guys with all of that, but it'll involve a lot of us laughing at each other. But it was truly, for us, from a personal perspective, I think it was a truly growing experience. You learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about, I mean, just this, to care for a horse, much less 7, for that amount of time, and to keep them healthy consistently is an extreme challenge. And I think we all learned a lot about that. It's something you can spend a lifetime learning about. But And we also learned a lot about each other. And it was truly like powerful. I think I don't want to bore you with the list of learning, but we learned a ton about salmon. And that was part of our goal, was to learn about the diverse impacts of this fish. And, there are things being done, and there's also things that aren't being done, and changes that can be made, that would go a long way to save this this fish impacts so much, ecological, biologically, economically, there is so much spiritually. I mean, what we learn from people of how this fish has impacted them specifically, or their culture, generations of their own family, their livelihood, was mind-blowing. And to think that we are consistently losing them year after year after year is devastating. I had more than one occasion where I cried on behalf of salmon and steelhead on this trip because I was so moved. And I particularly am passionate about this fish. I love learning about them, and I'm just consistently blown away with the fact that something that is directly impacting the health of our planet, especially in the Pacific Northwest, and we're actively losing it. It disturbs me, and I hope in the end, the end goal of this film, in the event that we can get this film out, which is our biggest hope, that this will also move other people to do something about it, because that's what this ride was ultimately about. It was about revamping a conversation that's been going on for a long time. But getting that conversation to a point where there's actually action points of what we can do to make this difference, where humans can, ultimately continue to have a wonderful life and have these livelihoods that are so dependent on many different ways of how we impact river systems and the oceans and fish and all this stuff, but also doing everything that we do in a more sustainable way, to where we can also have salmon continue to be with us, because once they're gone, they're gone. That's it. They're gone.
And something to just add on top of that, something that a lot of people are ignorant about, myself included, up until I learned this, and this was hammered into my head, is when we talk about salmon this year, 2017, it's like, oh, we're having a bad year. And then next year the numbers are up and somebody's like, oh, we're having a great salmon year. The numbers are really returning this year. People have really lost track of what a good salmon year means. We used to have millions of salmon coming up the Columbia, and Redfish Lake and the Salmon River were just chock full of them. Just so packed with salmon. And now when I hear people say, oh, we're going to have 5,000 Chinook up this year, this is going to be a great year for salmon fishing, it's like, wait. There used to be close to a million of salmon, of Chinook salmon and sockeye and steelhead, and coming up every year. To have 5,000 come back is not a good year. So, that's just something to keep in mind. Don't be fooled by the articles and the people saying we're having a good year. Always be skeptical of that, and know what good used to mean.
Our paper here, our local paper here, and this was about 2 weeks ago, so I can't speak 100% to what the numbers are now, but 2 weeks ago our paper reported that two sockeye salmon had made it through to Redfish Lake, which is where we are the end destination of our ride. And sockeye salmon in particular are the salmon that Redfish got its name for. They are the ones that turn that bright red color during spawning. And, the numbers of fish required to turn an entire lake red that's a massive number. Granted, the entire lake, but a large portion of the lake. The reason it's named Redfish is because it turned red. And two fish, that's nothing.
Yeah.
Literally nothing. It's pretty much zero in the scheme of percentages. So it's a problem.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you guys, I mean, did you have sort of planned stops along the way to like help teach you guys like about some of this stuff? I guess I'm wondering like how you were sort of receiving some of this information about salmon that you were learning as you went along your journey.
We partnered with IRU and that's Idaho Rivers United. Really amazing organization trying to save Idaho's rivers and salmon being part of that. And they taught us a lot. We also learned from a variety of different people, from people who it's just their livelihood, like some tribal members of different tribes along the Columbia. We learned from a Coast Guard. What was his position?
He was a marine biologist for the Coast Guard.
And he taught us a lot about like what commercial fishing looks like and how that's affecting it. We talked to people at the dams. We stopped at the dams on the Snake. And we talked to people who were in charge of the juvenile fish coming downstream. We talked to elementary school, and we learned from some awesome kids in Lewiston. Like, we were telling them about what we were doing, and they were also fully immersed in learning about the salmon through their school at that current time. So it was like really perfect timing. We got to learn some cool facts from them. We really just like kind of opened ourselves up to take in as much information as possible, all while being, you know, objective and checking our facts and making sure, you know, and admitting all along, like, we're not the professionals, we're not the pros, we're just here to help them out, we're here to be a microphone for the people who really know what they're talking about.
Yeah, we just, so to answer your question, like, we also used, or not answer it, but answer it again, or more fully, I guess, is we scheduled interviews, or the film crew scheduled interviews with folks from all, I mean, as you can imagine, like the differences in voices of folks as we progressed in our journey, from, you know, farmers and ranchers to fishermen and all of these all actual experts in the field. This was all they all were interviewed, and pretty amazing conversations from the recreational fisherman who like has this deep connection to salmon just based off of a fishing relationship with his grandfather, to people who are, I don't know, farming and ranching outside of Lewiston. I mean, there's just such a diverse scheme of people who spoke about how salmon impact their lives and the river impacts their lives. So we definitely incorporated that in a huge way to our overall journey, is like learning about everyone's perspective on this. But like Kat said, still, we just want to be a microphone for salmon in particular, not necessarily a specific opinion, but just, we want salmon to survive, so let's find a solution.
So that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, what is the sort of action message, you know, like, how can people save salmon, you know, like, because it's not an easy question to answer, you know?
It's not an easy answer for sure. And honestly, it's not going to be regulating commercial fishing. It's not going to be taking out dams. It's not going to be, attacking Native Americans for overfishing or plucking them out of the stream. Like, it's none of that. Like, really what this comes down to is people need to get passionate and they need to stay passionate. And our problem is, in society, people tend to not get engaged and not stand up for things more than like going to the store and buying their groceries and typing on their iPhone. And, you know, people are kind of getting lost in society and forgetting to get passionate and do something about the world around them. And so my answer when people have asked me that is like, get involved with REU. Don't just donate to them once and walk away and be like, whew, did my part. Like, get involved, donate to them when you can, go to their events when you can, sign petitions when they have petitions to be signed, go to rallies, and really just get involved and stay involved. It's not just a one click of the button. Okay, I've done my part, and then walk away and like go continue with life. It's like, no, you've got to get passionate and stay passionate. And it's kind of daunting. And it goes back to Doc, the guy we stayed with in Astoria. He said, like, what we need to save the salmon is a revolution. And a revolution isn't just sitting on your computer and clicking a button. A revolution is like getting passionate and staying passionate. And so, yeah, it's not an easy thing. That's not an easy way for people to save the salmon. It's hard. This is not an easy topic. It's going to be hard. And then Caitlin, she has, you probably have an answer like about politics and right. Mm-hmm. Is that where you were going to go? Mm-hmm. Gosh, I know you so well. I'm going to let you take over with that.
There's so many things that are pressing from a political nature, you know, where we are in time right now, but all of this, unfortunately, it comes down to politics, and we as the body of people making up the voice of this nation, we have to be involved politically. And there's a lot of calls to, you know, write your representatives, go to your city meetings, go to your county meetings, go to things that where your voice can be heard. And no one wants to do that. It's not on the top of anyone's priority list, but in order for change to be made on top of, as a part of being passionate and staying passionate, you have to stay politically involved. And that doesn't mean writing your representative one time. Again, like you donate once, you write your representative and like, check, I'm done for, you know, at least 5 years. It's consistent. I write once a week. And I think that in order for change to actually be made, it's going to have to come from a political side of things. And it's not, if you can't expect anything to happen if you're doing nothing. And it's intimidating to a lot of people, and it's scary. And you think, well, what can one person do? Well, it's not one person. It's a lot of people. And so if a lot of people write, get involved, donate to the right places, because money does speak, but not just money, it's your time. It's like what you can give, please give, because money, time, passion, a really well put Facebook, social media post, getting involved with the right organizations and speaking up for them and being like, this matters to me, matters to all of us too. So just be involved as you possibly can. And it takes effort, but nothing's going to change without effort.
Another way that people could help is by donating to our film. We are going to make a big splash. We're going to be that big exclamation point for people to like, look. And so if people wanted to get involved with what we're doing, we have a huge amount of money to still raise for post-production. And we have a GoFundMe, which is linked on, if people visit rideforred.org, ride for red being red with two D's. And that's another way for people to like get immediately involved with what we're doing, and then watching the film, enjoying the film, and sharing it once it comes out.
Awesome. Fantastic. Yeah. And I'll definitely share those links on our show notes page so that folks can check that out.
Awesome.
You know, the last question I have for you guys is just, you know, what's next? I can only imagine that this journey has inspired ideas for future journeys.
Yeah, Caitlin's really inspired me. I'm a completely different person. I don't know what happened. There wasn't, I guess, one specific moment, but I just feel like a different human being than before this trip. Caitlin's totally inspired me to start learning how to climb.
Yeah.
And so I've been doing that recently. I'm no quick learner by any means, but I'm having a lot of fun doing it. And so next we're hoping to start doing some horse packing, mountaineering combo trips, and get out into some different mountain ranges and climb some mountains and have our horses waiting at the base for us when we get back. Stuff like that. But we have a couple in specifics. One being Caitlin's brain baby of the John Muir and climbing Whitney at the end. I have a lot of fun doing that. And I don't know. Who knows? Like, there's a chance that I might just hop on my horse at some point and just start riding and never come back.
Everyone laughs like that's like a joke, but
it's actually real. Like that could happen.
I've got her tracking device. I'll know how to find her.
Awesome. I love that. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to chat with me, guys. It's a lot of fun to learn about this really unique and amazing journey that you took. And super cool to hear about like the learning experience along the way and how you guys are sort of crafting this message to teach people about salmon. Super cool stuff. So thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for helping us spread the word. Yeah, it means a lot for people to get involved and use your social media format to get us out there. So really appreciate it.
All right, that was Caitlin Spradley and Kat Cannell, two participants of the Ride for Red. You can learn more about this fascinating story at rideforred.org or by heading over to the show notes page for this episode, which you'll find at wildlensinc.org/EOC131. If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. You can also leave us a review on iTunes if you're feeling particularly gracious and want to help others discover the show. Just search for Eyes on Conservation in the iTunes store or follow the link on the show notes page. The Eyes on Conservation podcast is a production of Wild Lens. Today's episode was produced by myself, your host, Matt Podolsky. Our theme music is by The Humidors.